Okay, so in this paper I'll be talking about the popular Australian song poem Banjo Paterson's Waltz of Matilda, written in 1895. I'll be making objections to aspects of both Prinz and Jarvis's arguments regarding historical poetics, but this needn't, I think, be controversial. I'm just trying to find a useful position to talk about poetics in the context of colonisation. At the conclusion of the article, Historical Poetics, Disprosody and the Science of English Verse, Prinz suggests that critics working in historical poetics would need to take into account the cultural specificity of poetic genres. We can read a contradiction here, as if the taking account can be practiced from a position outside cultural specifics, as if poetic genres could, while being differentiated on a cultural basis, somehow also transcend their cultural differences. The implication is that the poetic genres are already in place before specific cultures make their adjustments. But what if these very specifics, associated, for example, with the practice of writing English in a new land, make poetic genre redundant? There being no atextual or neutral or mutually agreed upon cultural specifics to resort to, I'm going to start with the poem itself, turning from it and back, proving perhaps both its exemplarity and exceptionality through the reading. This may seem like a fudge, I prefer shortcut, but as the audience is largely Australians, I assume I won't be able to get away with anything like pure fabulation. What, then, are Waltz of Matilda's specific poetics and how do we read them? It was while reading Prinz's article, largely concerned with Lanier's disprosodic theories, that I realised the obvious doubleness of Waltz of Matilda. As Prinz understands it, Lanier's theory of voice in a poem as simultaneously vocal and instrumental requires a double reading. The double aspect of Waltz of Matilda is that it is not just a song or a poem, nor even a song and poem, but a song within a song or song within a poem. It begins with narration of the swagman and then continues with the swagman singing or writing the title refrain. The title refers to this singing as well as to what the phrase signifies in multiple ironies and figurations, or we might say translations. Having, as Prinz put it, alienated voice from the human body, Lanier argues for the rhythmic experience of a national body. And as an instance of this, Waltz of Matilda is exemplary and also exceptional. The song was a contender, after all, in the 1977 national referendum to choose a new anthem and received the most votes in the ACT. As I stated in my abstract, Waltz of Matilda is unexceptional in terms of its colonial themes and tropes of land, loss, death, property, theft and authority. Also in representing relations with other species, which I didn't mention. These aspects contribute to its verisimilitude and legibility. The reader of Australian literature to some extent expects these things to be present, and as long as their consequences or reality are repressed, feels, I think, comfortable with them. The pathos of failure against authority, which features in Waltz of Matilda, is an established nationalistic affect belonging to Anzac as much as to Ned Kelly. Unlike the Anzac effort, but like the Kelly story, Waltz of Matilda only represents failure if you identify with the criminal and not with authority. I don't want to dwell on this or on the other themes, some, if not all, typical of the ballad in English, to name Waltz of Matilda's ostensible genre. Contra Prinz, I'm declining to consider Waltz of Matilda in terms of genre. Poetic genre is just, I'm suggesting, what is not culturally specific about the poetics of colonial Australia. According to Jarvis, the importance of genre for historical poetics and of poetic forms, read in generic terms, lies in the field's roots in comparative literature and Russian formalism. My own interest in form is rather to do with movements and relations, unconscious conventions and attractions, the cultural specificity of these gestures within a poem, and Australian history of these. They may be assembled in order to talk in terms of mode, or rather I suggest anti-mode, but not genre. I'll probably get shot down for this. Anyway, more on this later. While this approach may, contra the CFP, seem to be exemplifying my own claims, I'm not sure how otherwise to deal with the problem of cultural specificity. I'm interested in how poetics emerges from cultural specifics rather than how cultural specifics might qualify poetics. In What is Historical Poetics, Jarvis notes that there are at least two kinds of thinking in poetry, semantic and syntactical, and metrico-rhythmic. I propose that we consider what might be called spatial or distributive thinking. Not spatial in the static sense that is opposed by Stanley Fish to the temporal, where spatial refers to the shape on the of the printed page and temporal to the developing shape of actualization of a poem's meaning as we read. According to Fish, approaches which treat a poem as an artifact in which the critic discovers frequency distributions, traces out patterns of imagery, etc., determinedly ignores what is true about the activity of reading. Yet there is, I would argue, active spatial aspects to reading also, and to writing. Not only do our bodies move and align ourselves when and with what we are reading, we mentally allocate space to what we write and read and prepare a space for what we might write or read next. I'm talking about a spatial poetics that is distinct from a poetics of space, whether Bachelardian or post or anti-Bachelardian, though I think there is an interesting crux here to be explored. I am rather inclined to an active notion of the spatial as described by Paul Carter. I'm borrowing from a colonial history context. Carter writes, "The facts of this spatial history are not houses and clearings, but phenomena as they appear to the traveller, as his intentional gaze conjures them up. They are the directions and distances in which houses and clearings may be found or founded." If we adapt this scenario to one of reading poetry, we might think that there is an active, if not conscious, dematerialising aspect to reading, as well as materialising, as we make space for things, tropes, voices, which don't appear. When we read or orchestrate changes in a poem, for example, a voice, or the occurrence of metaphor and other tropes, they may be more or less performed or experienced as structural fact or narrative or semantic meaning, but they might also be thought of as producing an analogous conceptual construct or shadow of the poem. This shadow structure is in, I think, addition to the scene that may be imaginatively constructed from a poem's narrative or descriptive aspects. We have then a doubly spatialized form as well as the poem on the page or object. This kind of thinking might be related to both syntax and rhythm, aspects which Jarvis distinguishes between as different kinds of thinking, though I'd be inclined to bring them together. They are closer, though, I think, to Marjorie Perloff's notion of page prosody and of a kind of meta or macro syntax. While individual studies of colonial poets' conventionally prosodical concerns, those of, say, Mary Gilmore or Henry Lawson, might be interesting, I suspect we might find ourselves resisting the tyranny of synecdoche, of line as evocation of contemporary and historical English movements. My sense is that from Field to Ujerud to Johnson to Edwards, as we had yesterday, meter and rhythm are more appropriative and strategic than praxis invested, a means to an end. What is it I'm suggesting more crucial is the cultural specifics of line, trope and voice. What do they mean? What do they do? How do they operate? I think an amount of strategic repression is called for by colonial poetics. Repression is, of course, a prevalent theme of colonial meta-narrative, predominantly that of repressing the knowledge of Aboriginal dispossession of land and the clearing of civilizations. The battle for possession in Waltz and Matilda is over the jumbuck, which might be read as synecdoche not just of the sheep station, but of the shearers' labour battles then current. But let's finally start reading the poem, beginning with its first word, once. Once, of course, relates to exceptionality of a former unity now past. The recalled events only happened, could only happen once, and so they are worth telling about, singing about, over and over. The repetition, the sharing, the warning of the refrain extends a space around the billabong, reinscribed as prison, where the swagman is made an example of, but where does the space, the voice differentiation, or we might say refrain translation, and the troping go? May our voices be heard over the brave cliché? That there are relevant events outside the poem that make it exemplary is legible only to those who have the requisite cultural capital. The production of Australia, its culture and identity, depends or turns on the idea of the exemplary and the exceptional, on owning things that are or happened far away in the double Australias of land and mind. The narrative of Waltz and Matilda appears to occur in a generalised bush, which means repressing Australia's plurality of cultures as well as the actual site of events at Dagworth Station in central West Queensland, which is, I believe, part of Kaur country subject to a current native title claim. If something happened once, it is, of course, past. Although the fictionalised events of the song are contemporary with the song, it is cast as already nostalgic. The fuller phrase, once upon a time, which begins folk and fairy tales, is understood. But if we think of it as a truncation, then we might understand it, hear it, as broken off, split, turned from its origin. Patterson has the reputation of being a romanticiser and fabulator of the bush. But Waltzing Matilda's romanticised view of a suicidal swagman, however familiar in ballad terms, also relies on a turn from the pastoral. This is what I'm arguing once signifies. Once, the end, begin again. Now I'll consider two structural moves in Waltzing Matilda, moving back and forth between reading the split and the turn, before a more extensive argument related to the turn. As noted, Waltzing Matilda can be read as a song within a poem. The voice is split between narration and narrated singing. It is, however, more complex in that it is split again by the voice of authority. The initial two voices in its artificial scene of narrator and swagman provoke then a parodic scene of pastoral. There are two voices. One is singing and bragging, and a sheep or jumbuck. The scene takes place on pastoral property. Therefore, the context presents the voices as tropes, as belonging to shepherds in some sense, ironically and parodically. The whole song is, in fact, about ironic care, that is, anti-care. Patterson's parody pastoral features one itinerant worker or swagman, an ironic or a parodic worker, perhaps a walker, mainly. On seeing a sheep, one sheep, his reaction is to stick it in his tucker bag as ironic reward for working once, that is, in the past or pre-poem. As the line goes, he grabs it with glee. We might say he grabbed it as he would grab a partner in a barn dance, in parody of a waltz, which, of course, the poem's title refrain already parodies. The three steps of the waltz correspond to the syllables of Matilda, a step to the sheep, a step to or away from squatter and police, a step to the water. As pastoral, the poem is parodically reductive. The voice that begins the text is a godlike narrator, godlike in the sense that it sees and knows everything, ultimate cultural capital. This is a swagman, this is how he feels, this is what he does, this is what happens to him. But a voice is not godlike in the sense of performing care or salvation. It cannot act as if embodied. In a sense, this voice is another parodic shepherd, the swagman's pastoral interlocutor. One shepherd body, one refrain to sing, one sheep to look after badly. One tree by water, as the set. Yet Patterson extends his parody in a further scene. Having grabbed the sheep, the swagman is inconveniently costed by a squatter and three police. They then mock the swagman by using his own refrain against him. The mode is shifting to tragedy or opera as they apparently sing in chorus. This then is a further split of the poem's voice, ironically, through repetition, loosening the refrain which stands in for the poem from the swagman and giving it ultimately to the nation. When sung, the refrain belongs to the singers. It is a commentary against the individual and a demonstration of cultural capital. We sing it as an identifying, unifying marker of Australianness. We don't need to know what the words mean. We know what the song means. In an article on mid-20th century poet David Campbell, Chris Wallace Crabbe formulates what he calls squatter pastoral, Patterson's influence on squatter mode, Empson's claim that pastoral implies a beautiful relation between rich and poor. Wallace Crabbe condenses this implication further as pastoral dissolves class envy. It is in these terms that we can read Waltzing Matilda as anti-pastoral, despite the possible momentary dissolution of class envy in the singing of the song. I don't have time to go into the broader history and wider practice of Australian anti-pastoral, most notably associated with John Kinsella, although I note that we could perhaps reframe Kinsella's project as a protest against the unbeautiful relation between farmer and land, of human and non-human. Waltzing Matilda is not about a beautiful relation between rich and poor, any more than is Kelly's jewellery letter, to give just one example. Perhaps anti-pastoral can be said to be an exemplary mode of much Australian poetry, not to mention other genres via Empson's formula. We might also perceive the influence of the beautiful relation in the euphemistic term settler. The earliest use I've found of settler poetics is that of Linda Hardy in 1995 in an article published in Meridian. She uses it as a term which seems to be transferable across Australian and New Zealand cultural contexts, and one which she refers to as enacting natural occupancy. As a term applied in Australian poetry criticism, it has emerged quite recently, used by a number of younger poetry critics, including Cassidy, Etherington, Wood, Newell, Araluen and Cook. Pardon me. In my own writing, Australian Unsettlement, I don't use the phrase as such, but I do imply that the modes of poetics available are that of settler and Indigenous. I think it's a term worth troubling, however, for while we might comfortably ascribe settler poetics to the poetry of Patterson, can we be so comfortable when we look at the poetics of a particular poem like Waltzing Matilda? While natural occupancy might be said to reside in the scene of the poem, but note that the scene is emptied by Patterson, to conflate the squatter, police, swagman, sheep and horses as aspect of settler poetics is to univocalise something that isn't univocal and to impose a beautiful relation against the text's explicitly unbeautiful plot. What, for example, of convict poetics? What I'm interested in is a theorisation of Australian poetry as a beginning activity in the circumstances of contact, in that moment's problems of communication and translation, in the trope of terra nullius, and in the affirmation of British culture and the effect of that affirmation on the land and on existent Aboriginal civilisation. In other words, I'm thinking about poetics in these specific cultural circumstances. Now I'd like to focus on the figure of the turn. The turn... Okay. Yep. I've got three paras. The turn has a foundational relation to poetry in two ways. The turn of the line, metaphorically derived from the turn of the plough in the word verse, and secondly, in the trope. These are concepts that any reader brings to the majority of poetry written in lines and employing figures. There are comments to make, however, an agriculturally specific nature. The turn of the plough is not a simple function. It both turns to make a new furrow and it turns the earth. Figuratively speaking, it suggests both the directionality of the line and the conceptual nature of language or ideas, drawing on previous uses that are the ground of what is being newly written, and further suggests that the words are waiting under the whiteness of the page or screen to be turned up. Either version has specific entangled implications for Australian poetry. To plough the ground means to affirm agriculture and therefore colonisation. The claim of ground as property by settlers is enforced by fencing. To plough of unfenced ground suggests turning in a convenient manner while avoiding things like rocks, trees, water. To plough ground that is fenced in means a very particular ploughing predetermined by the paddock or field's size and shape. The plough cannot reach the fence, there must be room to turn, hence something more resembling a page of the margin. As a figure, then, a ploughed field more closely resembles a page of prose than one of verse. Comparatively, it makes poets seem very fanciful. Plough a little here, plough a little there. Another aspect of the definition relates to turning the earth, the line as furrow. As I've said, agriculture is an Australian context. In an Australian context, isn't innocent or natural. It begins with and constitutes British colonisation. Writing in lines is then a settler activity, one rhetorically based on the assertion of farming the land. Therefore, all writing in lines affirms settlement, regardless of whether, as in Waltzing Matilda, the themes of land, property, theft, loss, etc., are explicitly present or not. However consciously we know this, if the meaning in the soil is imperial meaning made up of imported grains and ideas, then these things are not waiting in the soil to be revealed. If there is nothing on the page or screen, and this is a figure of a field, then is that of a cleared field, as if we write, figuratively speaking, on the pages of those who have written before. There is no field or ground on the earth that is originally empty. It must be emptied. To think that a page is to be filled with culture in the form of language or poetry as implicated in the term verse through ploughing writing is to evoke Australian colonisation's determining figure, that of terra nullius. Terra nullius means civilisations are not legible in the way they are in Europe. Its assertion of Latin literacy standing in for a lack of cultural capital to read what is present. And it means a clearing project, the enforcing of the unbeautiful relation, at times perhaps written as a beautiful relation, but not in Waltzing Matilda. So I'm stopping there. I do have more about troping and problems of trying to queer a poem, an Australian poem. But that's all. Thanks.